News, I'm Tommy McNeil.
AP correspondent Eric Tucker reports that special counsel Robert Mueller did not reach a conclusion whether or not President Trump obstructed justice.
Instead, according to Attorney General Barr, who summarized these findings, Mueller presented evidence on both sides of the ledger for these different episodes involving Trump's behavior that were examined and then did not reach a conclusion one way or the other. However, Barr said that he and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein had reached their own conclusion based on Mueller's evidence and determined that it was insufficient to establish obstruction of justice.
But President Trump did react after the news.
There was no collusion with Russia, the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. There was no collusion with Russia. There was no obstruction, and none whatsoever. And it was a complete and total exoneration.
An Afghanistan official said that there are going to be and have been ongoing clashes with Taliban insurgents, and it continued Sunday in southern Helmand province, resulting in the deaths of dozens of government forces. A Taliban spokesman said its forces overran two bases in Sanjan and killed at least 52 soldiers. The defense ministry in Kabul confirmed the fighting in the volatile southern district, but said officials were still gathering battlefield details. U.S.-backed Syrian fighters cleared explosives Sunday in the last area retaken from the Islamic State group and arrested a number of militants hiding in tunnels. This comes a day after declaring military victory in the end of the extremist self-claimed caliphate. The U.S.-led coalition said operations will continue until the area is completely secure. A spokesman for the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces said Baghouz village, where the militants made their final stand, is full of all kinds of explosives. This is VOA News. Viking Ocean Cruises says all the passengers and crew of its Viking Sky are safe and that the ship has docked in Norway after it had to be rescued. AP correspondent Julie Walker.
The cruise ship made it to shore Sunday accompanied by tugboats. The day before, passenger Alexis Shepard from California shared video online of what happened when they hit rough seas and issued a mayday after engine trouble. Chairs and other furniture went flying across the floor, and part of the ceiling came down.
I'm a yachtswoman. I've spent a lot of time on yachts, and this was unlike anything that I've ever experienced before. So, yes, it was absolutely horrible.
Officials say at least 17 people were injured. More than 400 of the 1,300 passengers were airlifted off the boat. The next trip for the Viking Sky has been canceled. I'm Julie Walker.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his chief rival, former chief of staff Benny Gantz, are speaking at the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee meeting this week in Washington. But only Netanyahu is scheduled to meet with President Trump and attend a state dinner at the White House. This comes just days after Mr. Trump announced a change in American policy on the Golan Heights, which Israel seized from Syria in 1967, later annexed. Mr. Trump tweeted last week that the United States recognizes Israeli sovereignty over the territory and later explained in the move in an interview with Fox News Business that he compared his decision last year to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The death toll from Cyclone Idai in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi has risen to more than 750 as crews work to restore electricity, water, and to try to prevent the outbreak of cholera. AP correspondent Karen Shamas.
As floodwaters recede and more bodies are discovered, the final death toll in Mozambique alone could rise sharply, with over 100,000 people already displaced in camps more than a week after Cyclone Idai hit. As efforts to rescue people trapped by the floods wind down, aid workers across the vast region are bracing for the spread of disease. Environment Minister Chelsea Correa says he's expecting cholera and malaria to spread in the country soon. The UN has made Cyclone Idai hit areas a priority in its humanitarian relief work, as the UN's Sebastian Rhodes-Stamper explains.
There's no government in the world who can respond alone in these types of circumstances.
I'm Karen Shamas.
The polls in Thailand's first election in 5 years have closed. Thailand's military junta took power in May 2014 when then Army Chief Prayut Chan-o-cha led a coup that toppled the government. The leader said Sunday morning after voting that he hopes everyone helps each other by going to vote. About 51 million Thais were eligible. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Monday, March the 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. The highly anticipated report from Special Counsel Robert Mueller says that neither President Donald Trump, his campaign, nor anyone associated with it conspired with Russia to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. That's according to a summary by Attorney General William Barr released yesterday. A new report says that 1,000 people have now contracted Ebola since the outbreak was declared in the Democratic Republic of Congo in August of last year. The UN says that death toll from a massacre in a central Malian village rose to 134 people dead.
The area in which this massacre occurred, and to be clear, this is the latest in a cascade of massacres that have happened in this particular area, which is bordering, in the area bordering Burkina Faso.
That's Corinne Dufka. She is the West Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. And three schoolgirls in Burundi are facing 5 years in prison for drawing on the president's face in their school books.
Schoolgirls in prison doesn't take into account the child's best interest, which has to be observed and which is put forward by the UN Child Rights Convention.
Yive Ishimwe is a member of FENADEB, an association that protects children's rights in Burundi. We're covering those stories plus sports coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Special Counsel Robert Mueller says that neither President Donald Trump, his campaign, nor anyone associated with it conspired with Russia to interfere in the 2016 presidential election in the U.S. This is according to a summary by Attorney General William Barr, who received the report late last week. Earlier this month, U.S. lawmakers unanimously voted on a measure demanding the full Mueller report to be released to the public. Many lawmakers also want to see any evidence that Mueller used to reach his conclusions, especially now that Barr wrote that Mueller report does not exonerate Mr. Trump, even if the president says it does. Meanwhile, President Trump has announced a presidential delegation to attend the inauguration of Senegal's President Macky Sall. President Sall will be inaugurated on April 2nd in Dakar, Senegal. The U.S. delegation will be led by Mark Green, the head of the United States Agency for International Development. A new report says that 1,000 people have now contracted Ebola since the outbreak was declared in the Democratic Republic of Congo in August of last year. The International Rescue Committee says that this is a milestone, and it's a reminder that Ebola is not yet under control, advising that in order to make progress in fighting the outbreak, there needs to be more work to create partnership with the affected community to deal with community mistrust and security issues. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. The United Nations says that more than 130 people were killed in an attack on a Fulani village in central Mali on Saturday. Survivors of that attack accused traditional Dogon hunters of carrying out the deadly raid in a village of Ogosagu. A spokesperson for the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that he was shocked and outraged by reports of the killings, and he called upon authorities in Mali to investigate and bring perpetrators to justice. Experts on the region say that attacks in this area are fueled by accusations of Fulani herders grazing cattle on Dogon land and disputes over access to land and water. But the presence of the jihadists in the region has further complicated the relationship between these two groups. And for context on the dynamics behind this conflict, I reached Corinne Dufka. She is the West Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. Corinne has covered this conflict extensively and joins me online from Washington, D.C. Corinne, thank you for joining us today on Daybreak Africa. Can you start off by telling us what is the history of this conflict and explain to us some of the groups of people involved and the kind of disagreements that they have with each other?
Yes. Well, the area in which this massacre occurred, and to be clear, this is the latest in a cascade of massacres that have happened in this particular area, which is bordering in the area bordering Burkina Faso. You have a number of different ethnic groups, but primarily you have the Fulani or Peul, which are largely herders, and then you have the Dogon, who are primarily engaged in cultivation. And so there have always been some tension between these two groups over access to land and water. But they have always been able to settle their differences through local reconciliation mechanisms. Since about 2015 or 2016, as armed Islamists began digging in and expanding in central Mali, and then later toward, in 2016 down towards Burkina Faso. Mm-hmm. Now, the Islamists have concentrated their recruitment on the Fulani. They have tried to do this by exploiting grievances over corruption, over lack of justice, over banditry, and so on. So as the Islamists have attacked on occasion some key members of the Dogon community, the Dogon armed themselves and organized the self-defense group to defend their villages from the increasing presence and attacks by the armed Islamists.
Okay. So it is reported that the Dogon, in this instance, the Dogon attacked a Fulani village. Was this in retaliation of an earlier attack? Have there been recent reports of fighting in that area?
Yes, there have been. So for over a year, there has been a relentless tit-for-tat between armed Dogon and armed Peul or Fulani in that area. And last week, there was an incident in which we understand four Dogon were killed, probably by armed Islamists. A few weeks ago, there was an incident in which a young Dogon went missing. His family went looking for him. They found him dead. And as they were trying to bury him, where they found him, an IED went off, exploded, and killed 17 members of that Dogon family. So the armed, and that is, you know, allegedly involving or was allegedly planted by the armed Islamists. So there have absolutely been atrocities against the Dogon community. However, they have engaged in, this militia has engaged in reprisals that have killed dozens of Peul villagers. They have, in fact, engaged in collective punishment against entire Peul villages.
So it doesn't matter whether these villages or the people in these villages are either part of these jihadists operating in that region. They just kill wholesale whichever Fulani, they attack a village and everybody is killed.
That is correct.
Like you said, there are jihadist elements operating in this region. How did they come to be in play, and how has their presence amplified this conflict?
Yeah, what has happened in central Mali since 2015, 16, and then in Burkina Faso, and certainly along this area, which has been affected by by this violence, including that violence on Saturday, is a result of the insecurity which occurred in Mali in 2012, when Mali fell to separatist Tuaregs and armed Islamist groups in the north, and when the French-led intervention came in 2013 and tried to sweep away those armed Islamist groups. Some of them started moving south, and they started their recruitment and focusing their expansionist or localization efforts on the areas in central Mali and northern Burkina Faso, and again, concentrating their recruitment on the Peul group.
And finally, yeah. Corinne, do you know of any efforts by by international bodies like the UN or any local organizations, including the central government in Mali, to manage this conflict in ways that there are no more casualties?
Well, I think the Malian government has overemphasized reconciliation efforts over justice. And we believe that had they early on arrested and questioned and ensured justice for some of the earlier massacres that occurred even a year or 2 years ago, that we wouldn't have reached to this point. So we're concerned about that. Now, that said, they have today, to their credit, announced that they are disbanding this abusive militia group. That is a step in the right direction. But they absolutely have to ensure that the leaders of these organizations and, of course, those perpetrating violations against the Dogon are investigated and brought to justice, because otherwise this very deadly cycle of violence will not end.
Corinne, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Corinne Dufka. She is the West Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. She joined me on the phone from Washington, D.C. Human rights activists in Burundi are calling for a release of three schoolgirls that were arrested for scribbling on a photo of the country's president, Pierre Nkurunziza. The students, who now face 5 years in jail, were transferred to a prison in Ngozi pending investigations. This is not the first time children are targeted in Burundi. In 2016, authorities also arrested school children for doodling on images of President Nkurunziza. From Bujumbura, reporter Moses Havyarimana has more on this story.
Seven students were arrested in Kirundo province, located in the northern part of the country, accused of scribbling on the President Pierre Nkurunziza's photo. They were brought before the public prosecutor in Kirundo as 13-year-old being below the age of criminal responsibility was released. Six girls were taken to the local police station cell, from where the three of them were later released. But the three other teenagers under the age of 18 were transferred to a prison in Ngozi pending investigation. Yves Ishimwe is a member of FENADEB, an association that protects child rights in Burundi.
We are so much concerned about this situation because we think, we estimate it doesn't take into account the child's best interest, because we are convinced that the child's place has to be at school and the family. There are school regulations which are in place since 2017 and which we think put in place measures which are to be taken on mistakes made by students in the school environment.
According to the activists, the students are yet to be sentenced but were detained awaiting the findings of the investigation after being accused of scribbling on the president's photo in their books. Yves Ishimwe says this is a violation of children's rights.
We regret that the measure to put those schoolgirls in prison doesn't take into account the child's best interest, which has to be observed and which is put forward by the UN Child Rights Convention, which is also which has been ratified by Burundi since 1990.
Last week, the students were charged of insulting the head of state and could spend up to 5 years in prison if found guilty. The Central Africa Human Rights Watch director, Lewis Marge, condemned the government's act, saying that the authorities should focus on holding perpetrators of serious rights violations to account instead of jailing school children for doodles. Burundi government couldn't comment on the arrest of the students, but a professor in one of the universities in Burundi who preferred not to reveal his name said that the school rules and regulations would have been applied.
They are teenage girls, so scribbling into textbooks, it's normal. All people, while they are adolescents or teenagers, they do things. When they see a drawing, they try to imitate. So this should not have been an offense that could be sanctioned by the penal code. But as they are schoolgirls, the school rules could have worked instead of using the penal code.
The arrest of the schoolgirls comes barely a week after the UN Commission of Inquiry in Burundi indicated gross human rights violations by the security forces and Burundi's ruling party youth wing Imbonerakure. The commission warned that there could be a gross human rights violations before and during the 2020 general elections. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Kenya is among the top five African countries with a high prevalence of tuberculosis. Health experts say that almost 30,000 people die from the disease. And as the world marked World TB Day yesterday, Sunday the 24th, the Kenyan government announced a new strategy to fight TB. Maureen Ojambo reports from Nairobi.
Tuberculosis is the fifth cause of deaths in Kenya. In the past 1 year, Kenya reported and treated 96,434 TB patients. Speaking during the marking of World TB Day, Health Cabinet Secretary Cecil Kariuki urged stakeholders and partners to continue supporting the ministry.
In Kenya, TB is number five leading cause of death. That is not a very happy statistic to share, but that is a reality. For us, we are targeting to be done by the year 2025.
Under the theme 2019 World TB Day, it's time to end TB. Some of the TB survivors say most of the hospitals mistake their symptoms of bacterial infectious disease to other diseases like pneumonia. A diver and a DJ, Eliud Chichi, who is a TB survivor, says it took doctors more than 5 years to tell that he was suffering from TB. Chichi says having suffered from TB, which was cured in the year 2012, in the year 2014, he developed lung problem and now his lungs fail frequently. He is forced to walk around with the portable oxygen concentrator machine to boost his breathing system.
My era started in 1992. This is when I started coughing. I used to visit private facilities whom were treating pneumonia. This went on from 1994, still treating pneumonia.
Another TB survivor, Joanne Ogola, a high school teacher, narrates her encounter with tuberculosis, which attacked her a few days after childbirth.
My journey with TB started after I had my baby last in April. So after that, I just thought it was postpartum complications. But then I started coughing and getting really tired. I didn't know what was happening.
TB remains the world's deadliest infectious killer. According to the World Health Organization, each day, nearly 4,500 people lose their lives to TB, and close to 30,000 people fall ill with this preventable and curable disease. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Thank you, Maureen. And still in East Africa, a new political party in Uganda wants to take on President Museveni in the country's next elections. Mr. Museveni was recently endorsed by his ruling NRM party to stand again in the 2021 polls. The new party is headed by former army commander Mugisha Muntu. Mr. Muntu says that his party, the Alliance for National Transformation, will help bring about change in Uganda. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report from Kampala.
While addressing ruling party leaders last week, President Museveni, who has been in power since 1986, repeated his earlier promise to ensure Uganda attains a middle-income economic status once elected again in 2021.
Thank you for again showing confidence in me, and I can assure you some very important things will happen, but I want you to help me uproot poverty from Uganda.
But senior Alliance for National Transformation, or ANC official, Alice Alasso, faults the leading party, the NRM, for not doing enough to bring about development in Uganda.
There are ordinary Ugandans who have lived under difficult conditions for the last 30 years. Our hospitals do not have drugs. Our mothers still die giving birth to children. So, and the population is very aware.
Alasso, just like General Mugisha Muntu, the founder of ANC Uganda, we are prominent members of Uganda's largest opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. For VOA News, I am Ogume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
In Nigeria, the fashion industry has been making leaps and bounds, and social media is helping fuel the growth. With increasing access to the internet and over 100 million mobile lines, social media platforms like Instagram are becoming a marketplace for emerging fashion entrepreneurs. From Lagos, Samuel Okocha reports on how this is happening with the one-time style blogger.
Few years ago, Abike Domina started as a style blogger, sharing fashion tips on social media. Now, she styles celebrities for events and runs her own fashion line powered by social media.
At the end of the day, you don't even have so many people walking in into your store or your office to say they want to get what you have there. But like me, 95% of my client comes from Instagram. That's where the popularity is. Instagram is just like a saving grace.
With over 40,000 followers on Instagram, Abike Domina engages her audience with a mix of content on motivation, style, and information on her latest designs. But she says her work as a stylist for celebrities has given her fashion design business more exposure.
It has really helped me a lot because I gained their exposure, their own fan base to become my own fan base. Like someone that has 6 million followers and is acknowledging me and introducing me to that 6 million followers, I'm sure even if I can't reach all of them at that time, some of them are already aware of who I am. So by the time they hear your name again from another person, another public figure, it rings a bell.
Abike Domina is one of many businesses taking advantage of social media to grow our brand and business. Lagos-based SME growth specialist Chuka Monya says Nigeria's vibrant entertainment industry is opening up opportunities for small businesses like that of Abike Domina, serving the growing entertainment scene.
If you look at the entertainment industry, you have a lot of small businesses in the entertainment industry. They're just doing what they're doing. They're just finding out how they can move their new music or their new video. They're trying to get new projects outside the country. They're trying to earn foreign income. So people are thinking outside the box, and that's what one needs to really think about.
Meanwhile, Abeka Domina has some words of advice for upcoming fashion entrepreneurs.
Do whatever you do for the passion of it, and always learn new things. Always read, always do research.
Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
This is Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. It is time now for sports news on the continent. For that, we have Samson Omali in Abuja. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, Jackson. We begin the sports with the confirmation that all 24 teams for the 2019 African Cup of Nations slated for Egypt have emerged. Their confirmation follows the conclusion of the final group matches, which were played across various venues this past weekend. Riyad Mahrez's Algeria are among the countries in what will be the first time the tournament has expanded from 16 to 24 teams. Four teams qualified in total from North Africa. They are Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia and Egypt. Burundi, Madagascar and Mauritania all qualified for the first time in their history. All the teams to qualify from East Africa include Uganda, Tanzania, and Kenya. South Africa were the final team to qualify, and Namibia also made it for the first time since 2008. Angola, Zimbabwe, and Madagascar complete the southern section. Cameroon, who are the defending champions, and DR Congo booked their places over the weekend. West Africa has the most amount of teams. Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, Senegal, Mali, Nigeria, Benin Republic, Ghana and Ivory Coast will all be in Egypt in June and July 2019. There is no place for Gabon and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who is most certainly the biggest player to miss out of Africa's most prized football competition. Burkina Faso, Zambia and Cape Verde also did not qualify. Meanwhile, the draws for the tournament will take place on Friday, April 12, 2019 in Cairo. And now to Nigeria, where Nigeria's under-19 male cricket side, the Junior Yellow Greens, on Saturday qualified for the ICC Under-19 World Cup slated for January in South Africa by 2 wickets. The Nigerian side sealed their qualification after winning their last match against Sierra Leone at the ICC World Cup Africa qualifiers in Windhoek, Namibia. Sierra Leone won the toss and elected to bat first, sending in Nigeria to field for the first time in the tournament. Nigeria started on a bright note with a bowling attack on point and with Sierra Leone struggling to piece together a decent partnership. It is the first time Nigeria under-19 male cricket team will ever make it to the World Cup in their history. In athletics news, Prisca Jeptoo and Vincent Rerimoy claimed a Kenyan double at the 44th edition of the St. Milano Half Marathon in Milan on Sunday. Held in warm weather condition, Prisca Jeptoo returned from a 2-year maternity break to win the women's race in 1 hour, 8 minutes, 26 seconds. Rerimoy, meanwhile, was a surprising winner of the men's race in 1 hour and 10 seconds, beating steeplechase specialist Jairus Birek to finish runner-up in 1 hour and 32 seconds on his debut at the distance. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
And that's it for this Sunday, March 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We want to thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good week ahead, Africa.